Hello, everybody. Welcome to the Game On Your podcast.
This is the final in a three-part epic series of AES London 2013 Game Audio Podcasts, covering all of the hotness that has gone on during this conference. Anton, it's over.
It's over. We're not even in London anymore.
This is the rural Netherlands.
Yeah, we're in a pretty pristine old place called Giethoorn, which is a beautiful area where my dad happens to live. We're hanging out.
Just took a big walk around, a beautiful countryside. Your dog, Rommel, had a romp through the thicket, and it was just great to soak in a little bit of greenery outside after spending 3+ days in gray London.
Yeah, well, it wasn't that bad, actually.
No, and I say that only because it's such a stark contrast to where we are now.
Yeah,
but
for sure.
You know, to tell you the truth, I can't really admit to having seen much of outdoor London because I spent
all of it
inside at this conference, which was actually fantastic.
It was a great conference. Yeah. But before we wrap that up, let's take a look at yesterday.
Where'd we start?
We started, well, a false start. We were going to start with a talk about feature films and how a background in that can help you with designing audio, but that didn't happen.
Cancelled.
Cancelled, yeah.
So they pushed the poster sessions into that spot first thing in the morning. Which two did we see?
We saw one, let's see, what was it called? No, there's nothing here. What? Oh, there. Yes. Can interactive procedural audio affect the motorical behavior of players in computer games with motion controllers? A question a scientist would ask himself, perhaps.
Perhaps.
This case was Niels. I'm not going to try to pronounce his last name. I will butcher it, even though that might actually be his last name. He's at the Aalborg University of Copenhagen.
What was your summary? What was the takeaway from that? Kind of give us the lay of it.
Well, he did some experiments with comparing a procedural model and a sample-based playback of a Wiimote sword sounds. And I guess his hypothesis was that if you use procedural audio, you might have an impact on how much you use the Wiimote or a motorical device to immerse yourself, I guess.
Yeah, or kind of communicate the sound to the player.
Yeah.
He was taking synthesis, both samples and synthesis, in order to create these models. And they were, I think the intention was to tie it very directly to the movement.
Yeah.
I guess I felt like his presentation of the technical side was good. I don't remember exactly what the outcome of his emotional reaction was.
Well, I do. His conclusion was that it didn't work. But So he did a controlled experiment where one group would play with only the sample playback and the other would only play with the more dynamic sound. And he couldn't come up with a difference in experience for the two. To be honest, I am not convinced by what he said he did there. I think he just proved that it didn't sound really good.
I think there were two things, right? First of all, you know, procedural audio needs to be taken with a grain of salt right now. Synthesis, in particular. Because it doesn't sound as good as the real thing, and because we are so used to hearing the sample playback mentality, we can't really make that leap to procedural in order to gain the dynamic aspect of it, the dynamic control over synthesis, because the sound is a little janky, right? Alternately, I thought he was kind of brilliant at the end of his presentation when he tied it to a computer graphic render of a strawberry from SIGGRAPH back in 1995, I think it was.
No, 1978.
And the thing looked like a cardboard cutout.
Yeah.
Right? And which is, you know, everyone, I think, understands the genesis of
sure.
CGI. And, of course, no one would argue CGI today as a valid means of communicating story.
Mm-hmm.
And even realism at this stage. And I feel like we are still at that genesis with procedural and synthesis and game audio in that we've got cardboard strawberries for sound.
My problem is that we've had cardboard strawberries since before computer graphics had cardboard strawberries.
Yeah.
And that there are people that are going for the physical modeling, as in, you know, you want to have reality. There's not enough of those people to actually move that technology forward a lot. It's not really going anywhere fast because there's just not enough manpower behind it. If you see yet how many people are behind computer graphics,
mm-hmm.
it's insane how many people are working on that stuff for a long time. If you saw Absolutely. How from that strawberry that they showed there a couple years later, they had the whole animation, you know, not 10 years later. A few years later, they had, you know, the animation of the lamps that are the Pixar thing.
The Pixar lamps and the iconic teapot.
Exactly. You know, that wasn't long after 1978.
Right.
Nee, bommel. Sorry about that. Yeah, sorry.
Well, I agree. And I think that we're in an interesting place. We have been in an interesting place with synthesis. Now with accessibility at runtime to things like Pure Data in the libpd library, and some of the experiments that people are doing with tying various synthesis engines like MaxMSP, Super Collider to various game engines. You know, I think we are starting to have the potential to use modern day synthesis in a game environment.
Yeah, no. So I think that's, and I think that my point was also more of a, I don't think we're going to go there anytime fast in the physical modeling area, as in really trying to make something lifelike.
Yeah.
But I think creative use of synthesis is around the corner. I think yesterday we saw with Fabric, it's very close around the corner.
Yeah.
And especially, you know, the simple synthesis techniques that we've been using in music and everything sound design wise linearly. For a long time, you know, when we make sounds for games, we don't just use samples, we end up making samples. But the means to get to those samples can be anything, including synthesis of all kinds.
Right.
So it's not a completely new tool, we're just bringing tools that are offline now to the online world where we can just use the parameters that we're tweaking ourselves all the time and making 10 variations and use that to create a simple model at start of endless variation.
Yeah.
You know, we can tweak, fine-tune that button a million ways in-game instead of 10 times and then using the memory.
Yeah. And I think it's... I'm glad that he made his presentation and that there are people working in this capacity, because I think it has been an evergreen topic for a lot of years now. And it needs to continue to be in our consciousness. People need to keep continuing to see the value in its potential. And like you say, I think that we're right around the corner. People want it creatively, and you can see that with its adoption on mobile platforms for smaller games. And I think that potential will only continue to grow as more work gets done.
And actually, when I was a student, so this is going back first year of college for me, so 2004, mm-hmm. I think. Shit, it was almost 10 years ago now. So back in the first year, we got together with the game design department of the school that I went to. And they had gotten this, I think it was Moven, is that a motion capture company? Moven, no. Mm-hmm. Well, they built at the time very advanced motion capture suits with the skeletons on the side.
Gotcha.
You know, things that we laugh about now in motion capture, I guess, where either you're using the dots or you have the suits that are completely flexible.
Yeah.
But at that time, that was an expensive suit that they got for rent, and we could make a game with it. So they used an engine that they translated the data from the motion capture suit. Yeah. And remember, this is pre-Wii, so everybody was like, what can we do with motion in games?
Yeah.
And they built kind of this black and white type of game.
Sure.
Where instead of controlling it with a keyboard and mouse, that he would use it... Rommel. Kom maar af. Yeah. He would use it with this whole suit.
Yeah.
Usually you were the god over this village.
Yeah.
And we tied their engine to pure data and tied all the motion of that to either sample playback, like we had rain things, but we also had for things like wind, we were just using white noise with filter modulation.
Sure.
And because, you know, that tied in really nicely with all the movement, you combine a couple of those vectors and tweak the filter and the cue with those things, and, you know, it sounds different all the time.
Yeah.
And that's basically what he was talking about doing as well.
Yep.
Mm.
And I think that, you know, again, it was
but his study was about can you improve the physical relationship with the motion controller if you have a sound that is generative. But I don't think he proved anything there because the model just wasn't there. You know, if you then you have to show really the two best of the two. You can't have a very simple sample and a very simple white noise thing.
Yeah.
And then say, and then come to any kind of conclusion about the whole concept.
You have to start with an immersive sound experience.
Yeah, you have to make it good first and then see if people can tell the difference. Connect. Yeah.
Yeah. I agree. And so, in summary, I guess I'm glad that he presented his information because it keeps procedural on people's radar.
For
it,
sure, yeah.
It needs to stay on the radar because it absolutely has a place in the future of game audio. But again, as we just said, I think there could have been it could have been better. So after that, there was a pretty stunning presentation from Mike Caviezel from the Microsoft Game Labs.
Yeah.
He did a session called Plane, Trains, and Automobile, Creating and Implementing Vehicle Sound Systems.
First of all, Mike can present a talk.
He is a cowboy.
Yeah.
And not only can he stay on topic, but he can careen off wild and bring it back to a solid point.
Yeah.
And yeah, he's a great speaker.
And his enthusiasm, you know, even if it's not your subject, his enthusiasm for explaining how a combustion engine works and how that is relevant to your work as a sound designer on a game like Forza that he worked on.
Absolutely. Is,
even though I never worked on an engine type of game, totally bought into it completely. It's like, I'm hooked. Tell me more.
Yeah. Going deep on the internal combustion engine mechanics in order to illustrate the different sound aspects of an engine.
And also, why do you then need to record from different angles in the car?
Right, and then furthermore, how to, you know, appropriately utilize that sound technically in order to play it back appropriately.
Mm.
There was also a great thread running through his whole talk, just not necessarily as much about the specifics of, let's say, the technical sound or implementation aspect, but I felt like he really had a accessible presentation of what the components of sound for vehicles were from more of a listener perspective, right? The things that make you feel powerful or, you know, things you can do to give engine sounds their edge, right? Give the sound bite. I mean, he had a lot of great euphemisms that really helped kind of bring it into the real world as far as why you would want to do some of these things and how.
Exactly. He went from the start, like, what is your basic framework?
Yep.
And then built on that, well, how can we use that to make it a fun game? He didn't stop at, okay, this is how a car engine works and this is how we're going to reproduce it. That was just the ground layer of making it believable. But then how can we make that emotional? And he combined the two, and without even saying that, he made it the same thing. But he also showed, I think, a good example of being analytical and creative, technical creative at the same time, and how those two are not fighting each other.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, if you put the two next to each other and connect the wires.
Yeah. Yeah, well, and so he's given talks on vehicle sound for the past couple of years, and I have to say I've seen most of them. and he's always a entertaining speaker.
Hmm.
This one, more than the others, I felt like covered a wider range of some of the things you come across, and I feel like it was simultaneously deeper and more accessible at the same time. And so I guess maybe what I'm saying is that over these past few years of presenting on this, he has sharpened his axe.
Yeah.
And I heard from more than a few people yesterday that that was one of the favorite talks.
Cool.
Of Friday. Yeah. So that was a good one.
Yeah.
So.
Very interesting talk. This was titled An In-Depth Look at the Audio Engine in Hitman Absolution.
Right.
And IO Interactive, guys. Franz and Mikkel.
Right. And this is one of the only game-focused talks of the conference.
Mm.
Really the only post-mortem. Really the only one specifically looking at the technology and strategies used by a single studio. And, you know, a highlight, absolutely. What was your take on it?
Well, it was really inspiring. I think they're coming from, for me personally, where I'm working at and how they approach things, it was a lot of, yes, you know, exactly the kind of stuff that we were talking, what I had with Xavier's talk about HDR, and a lot of, yeah, I know what you're talking about there. You know, it's like talking about getting all these freedoms with new inputs from the games, much tighter integration with game engines, and that's something I've always really enjoyed doing. It's becoming much more part of the game dev team,
yeah,
which I think is just a really powerful thing for sound game sound designers. Is what sets you apart, I think, in game sound. And
I think that what their talk really did on that exact topic is, I think it showed three things. They showed three very powerful perspectives. First, they showed, you know, what their target was. Yeah. What were they trying to achieve with sound for a certain scenario or system,
mm-hmm.
right? Whether it was ambient or music, dialogue, you know, what was their goal, right? Secondly, they showed the tools. You know, what do we need to enable us to do this?
Yeah, and they thought about how they wanted their tools to work quite well. They definitely set the very clear ideas, not only of the problems they were having, like, I can't do this, I can't do that, but also, in general, what is our goal with our tool? What should it do generally?
Right, and their tool, when we say that, just to give everyone an idea, is really just another component of the game's visual scripting language. It was a node-based editor used by everyone working on the game.
Yeah.
And so their components in there are just another piece of that puzzle like any other node-based editor. Yeah. And so, absolutely, what do we need? How do we accomplish it? And, you know, they gave some great examples about places where they took it even farther than they expected to, because they knew that as they moved through production, they would need to have that technology. So
yeah.
They were smart about what they were building as they were building it.
Mm-hmm.
And then the third thing was, because it was a postmortem, they were able to show off in-game footage for each of these systems that really illustrated, you know, how they achieved their intention.
Yeah.
So being able to see that entire arc from intention to goal or accomplishment, I feel like for each system that they covered was was super valuable because it gave you, you know, a whole picture of their experience. That dialogue system they had was crazy.
Yeah, I missed the first part, so I didn't see the dialogue system too much.
Well, it was it had a radius-based influence, which would...
Oh, you mean the ambient dialogue?
The ambient
dialogue. Oh, yeah, I did see that. Yeah, okay, so I didn't miss it, no.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, that was really good.
Right, radius-based influence, which would calculate the number of NPCs which all subscribe to a certain state.
Yes, one thing we have to go back and say, Hitman Absolution had a crazy limit of NPCs. There was 1,200 individual NPCs potentially on screen.
Huge scenes.
Yeah.
Full of NPCs.
And judging from what I saw, for sure that is true. They were really like individually behaving, different animations, different things. And if you saw how they reacted to panic in those screenshots, I didn't play the game, but it definitely made me want to play it just to see how those crowds behaved.
Yeah. Well, in this sphere of influence radiating out from the player was the driver for their partially loop-based ambient walla.
Yeah.
Right? And so as they calculated these NPC states in this sphere around the player, they then would dynamically control the loops that were playing for various intensities of game state.
Yeah.
And yeah, I thought it worked great. You couldn't even tell what is systemic and what is loop based.
Yeah.
Because they had a great combination of both, you know, coughs, one-shot dialogue lines, incidental, you know, sound effects type things. Everything really well solidified within the background loops and whatnot, and completely dynamic, very reactive,
for sure,
and extremely immersive from a positional standpoint.
Yeah, and they showed a lot of in-game footage. One slight note there was that there was a lot of examples where the camera was wildly flying about, and it showed off the environment really well. But it kept me wishing, like, okay, but keep the listener in one spot for a little bit for me. Like I understand you want to show me everything, but I want to hear everything. And it was moving a little bit too fast. But luckily, there was also enough examples where they went in-game and had Hitman just play as the player would. And there you could really hear how the system worked very well.
Yeah, I agree with that. You know? And I think that the videos they did were probably made for the sake of brevity, to just keep everything moving.
But what I liked about it was if you move through it so fast, you could hear the amount of different content in there, and how if you moved around really quickly, you could just hear, oh yeah, that sound is there and that conversation is there. And they showed it really well, also with all the layers that are built into it.
Yeah.
You know, it's like an ambient conversation layer, then adding the... so they had an unintelligible walla, they had some chit-chat stuff that you could hear. Then they had the merchant stalking and the merchant sound effects.
Mm-hmm.
And then you had, what was the other thing? There was one more layer there. Some more conversations going on.
Mm-hmm.
And then that was tied to four states. I also really enjoyed their music demo where they showed the music states as colors. And I thought that was an interesting... We've seen state-based music systems before. You know, the fear emitter in Dead Space.
Splinter Cell.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. You know, so we've seen that kind of thing before, and maybe others have used this color paradigm for it too. But I thought that was maybe a very simple thing. But instead of giving it names where you tie into it a lot, you know, you would have a battle state or certain fear amount, or it abstract it one more time, you know, just give it. We have a lot of associations with red, of course, because it's a stop sign, because it's, you know, blood, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
But it it's ambiguous enough that you can also still use it and not feel like you're using it wrong too quickly, or, you know what I mean?
It's like, right, because the different state colors, for instance, were yellow, orange, red, and was there one above red?
There were four. So another thing, there was one above red, but as far as intensity goes, I think there was like one below. I don't know.
Okay. Anyway, yeah. They abstracted it into a color-based system, yeah. And you're right. When you do that, you remove this idea of whether it's right or wrong, and it just becomes a question of which one is appropriate.
Exactly.
So, yeah, good insight on that. Good insight. Well, so great job to those guys. That was great to see that. And again, I feel like it was a game audio conference, and this was the only one that was really focused on a game. And I think that it was a good one to have. It was the feather in the cap for that kind of talk.
Yeah.
So after that, I went downstairs in the basement. There were two rooms going on Friday. There was the upstairs room where the main conference was being held. And then they had all of the paper sessions downstairs in the basement in another auditorium. So upstairs in the big room was Global Game Audio Production, Where Are We Going?
Yeah.
And I didn't attend that talk, but I heard it was a talk all about localization, some of the tools that they were using for that, and techniques that are in current use, and a little bit about what the future holds, but from what I heard, not a whole lot. Down in the basement, Anton, I know you were there as well. We saw modular architecture for virtual world parametric spatial audio synthesis from the Aalto University.
Well, it sounds like a scientific title to me.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and that's kind of one of the things about these AES conferences is that you've got the flashy stuff upstairs, Hitman as the example, right? And that's the stuff that's going to be accessible. It's got a real-world equivalent, and it's easy for people to get on the same page with. Same with Mike's talk yesterday. And then the other side of AES, which is no less important, but maybe a little less shiny, are the papers and poster sessions. Now, these require a little bit more imagination on the part of those of us who are maybe not as technical in the field of audio. Especially when the program material we're being delivered is slightly pitched towards the scientific.
Mm.
But I think that the information that they're trying to bring across is so complex sometimes that that it can get bogged down in some of the minutia. And so, well, that said, Tapani did a really good job of laying out this idea for a virtual world spatial audio system. And I guess my big takeaway from it, there was a lot of, flow graphs and, digital audio, charts that mapped various conversions from a very technical perspective, way outside my expertise. But the main gist of what I got from it was that he was trying to suggest a future model for representing sounds spatially that allowed for the idea of an object that was emitting sound larger than a single pixel.
Hmm.
Right? So a current paradigm is a point source emitter is really just a single point in space, in 3D space. And from that we have this, ability to position into 3D, define its directionality through attenuation curves and sound cones, and then essentially maybe apply some kind of spread to it, depending on how many channels it has, in order to make the sound bigger or smaller in its projection mm-hmm. or propagation. And I think that if I got it right, his intention was to take away some of that abstraction that we have to deal with in trying to generalize the size of the projection from an object and instead give that object an actual size value that's directly correlated to how sound is transmitted from it, right? So the example here being that if your game object is a fly and it's buzzing around your head, that sound is very specifically going to come from a tight position in 3D space, right? It represents the size of the fly. Whereas on the other side, if a train is passing by, It may not be appropriate to represent that as a point in 3D space, but instead spread a multi-channel sound in front of the player based on distance.
Yep.
And have some kind of ability to adapt that spatially to the object in the game.
Yeah, and I think that volumetric sounds, which is how I would call it, is something we would definitely look at in future engines. Maybe there are engines out there that are doing it, because it doesn't... His solution was very much related to the Deer-Ock, what's it called? The Fraunhofer phase panning kind of algorithm.
Right.
So HRTF-based kind of thing.
It had a psychoacoustic foundation to the whole thing.
Exactly. And it was aimed for that kind of system. His research was sponsored by Fraunhofer.
Yep.
But in for game audio in general, not only having point sources is definitely something that's going to be part of the agenda, for sure.
And there were capacities for that for different encodings of different streams.
Yeah.
In addition to it.
Because currently we're kind of faking it a lot. You know, if I'm making a river and I make one sound for the river, I will just place it 20 times. Right. But you will get a little bit that, you know, if you're standing in between those two points, the panning is not super correct. You can compensate for it manually with the spread you put on them.
But well, and another technique, right, which is, again, just another abstraction, is to place an emitter and draw a line that emitter can follow along that river.
Right.
And now you have a single sound source tied to a manually authored line.
You're animating the sounds.
You're allowing that sound to dynamically move with the player.
Oh, right. So the position relative to the player is static, but it moves up and down with the source. The source is kind of on rails.
Exactly.
Okay.
Source is on rail dynamically, and so it's kind of cheating it a little bit, because you do still have to author it in the same kind of way, but it's not the same as just having the built-in capability to project sound volumetrically, kind of like you're talking about.
Right. Okay.
Yeah. So that was, I mean, again, it took a few drinks at the bar with him to get down to the reality of what he was getting across.
Yeah, and I asked some questions about it because he didn't really have any examples. So he was really addressing only a very small portion of his audience.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's a little bit of a shame, because a lot of people come out there. There was a room full of people, and you know in advance that this is not just a scientific conference. If it was a scientific conference, then sure.
Well, interestingly, he said he has presented this before. It's always been at a scientific conference.
Yeah, DAFX, which is where you would, Digital Audio Effects is a conference with everybody working in DSP.
Yep.
And that's definitely where you would expect everybody in the audience to understand your flowchart of your algorithm without explanation.
Well, he said the Audio for Games conference blew his mind. First of all, the community and the sharing of information. And second of all, you know, certainly the knowledge level of some of the people there was on par with what he was communicating. Yeah. But I think that he also had a realization where there was way more to it than just communicating that scientific side. And so a missed opportunity for sure, but I think that he's definitely taken in the experience. And from, again, a conversation we had later in the day, I think that, the next time he's going to come packing.
Yeah. Well, one thing that surprises me with some of those things, and not his one in particular, but others, is like, especially if you're talking about things that have a sound, so why would you then not bring that sound, if at all possible?
Right. Yeah, I agree. And again, maybe that's just not what he's been used to.
Yeah.
So, did you get a chance to check out any of the poster sessions?
No, but it was one more paper session after his. Franz Merkel, if I'm saying the name correct. You have the paper in front of you.
Fritz Menzer.
Fritz Menzer.
We're talking about integrating custom 3D audio rendering into game sound.
Yeah. I didn't watch it the whole way through because I really had to go and edit up the last episode that we did.
Yeah.
Which is also why I didn't get to see all the posters. But I saw a part of it. It was interesting what he was trying to demonstrate was... something that actually doesn't require a sound example. He was giving a different solution to how we render out audio. And he showed some interesting approaches to splitting up the processing and how that might be a lot more efficient. And I know that he's got a working example for FMOD going. People should probably look that up if they're using FMOD and see if that's interesting. So I didn't watch the end, so I'm not sure exactly like what his conclusion was, but this is a product you can buy, so I'm sure that he'll have a solution that's better than what's out there, I'm guessing. Otherwise, he wouldn't be presenting it.
Right. And that's the thing, is these papers will be available at some point. The documentation coming out of AES is prolific. And so, you know, we'll try to link to that in the future.
Yeah.
On the topic of posters, I didn't have a chance to sit down with anyone and chat about it. But just to read off a couple of them, just so we can kind of expose this other side of the conference.
Yeah.
You know, there were posters on the use of 3D head shape for personalized binaural, geometric and wave-based acoustic modeling using Blender. Mm. Sounds like a cool one.
Yeah.
Plausible mono to surround sound synthesis and virtual world parametric spatial audio. Whoa. Yeah.
It sounds like a scientific one. Is the title more than you would normally put in a line?
That's a lot of them. And one that I wish that I had seen called the Granular Analysis Synthesis for Simple and Robust Transformations of Complex Sounds. Now, this is work on that poster was done partially in consultation with Francois Thibault, who we had, if you remember, back
Procedural
on,
1.
Procedural 1. And so he was not directly involved with the project, but I did hear through Xavier from Audio Kinetic that he was involved as a mentor on that.
Okay.
So, you know, that's kind of an other side of this conference, right?
Mm.
It's that hugely technical stuff. There's a lot of action academically happening, and I think that what ends up happening at conferences like SIGGRAPH over on the visual side is you see a technical document, you see a paper presentation that is mind-bogglingly complex to the layman, and what ends up happening is 5, 10, 2 years later, it's been added to whatever whiz-bang tool set and exposed to artists who are taking advantage of it.
Yeah.
And so I guess I'm glad that the AES is pushing hard to also include that kind of programming for the event, because I think that what we'll hopefully see is kind of a trickle down of this high level scientific research.
Yeah, and also a trickle up,
yeah,
maybe, or if you want to call it that, of the what we're interested in. And this is what I was asking the other speaker too, on more the scientific side, is like, how can we see some more collaboration there, where you can maybe use a real engine instead, or use a real sound designer? For example, the guy with the Wii Motion Go. No, it's an interesting research to do, but why would you also want to do the sound design of it yourself?
Mm-hmm.
Why don't you collaborate with somebody who does that for a living?
Mm-hmm.
And see if you can, if you get somebody that's top of his game in that, you know, see where you can take it there. Because, an interesting analogy in science, using rats a lot, right, mm-hmm. for research. Turns out they didn't know a lot about rats. So a lot of research was done on an animal that I didn't really understand. So in certain sections of science, there was a lot of miss results because they were just failing to really understand how rats react, especially in psychology, early psychology with psychoactive medicine.
Sure.
There were a lot of
false
assumptions about what a result was on a rat, just because they didn't really understand how rat behavior worked. and this is ages ago, but I'm guessing, you know, if you really want to do this scientifically, then you can the collaboration will improve things.
And you know what I'm going to boil it down to is the two-way street, man.
Yeah,
it's like we all need to be talking in both directions.
Yeah,
up and down the tree, left and right, whatever you want to call it. You know, we all have a lot to learn from both sides of that equation, and I think that was true of a Tapani who I talked with, who afterward was like, I get it.
Hmm.
This conference is miles apart from the scientific community that I've been running in.
Hmm.
And I think that was an epiphany for him in the same way that I feel like, again, this scientific community and what they bring to the table is hugely valuable for what we're doing in the future.
And he said also during his talk, asked him about it, it's like, he sees a future for middleware to start taking those ideas and implement them and try them out. But I think he's not 100% correct there. I think also if you talk to some of the more technical game developers that were willing to take a risk and you present them with an interesting research and say, you know, can we on the side during pre-production or, you know, at a time when you're not in crunch, when you might have some time to experiment, because, you know, game developers like to experiment. It's not all about, you know, the dollar in the end. That's certainly a big part of it, but they're also trying want to do the new thing to give to their players something unique.
Yeah.
So they're definitely at the right time. There's time to take risks with technology too. So, you know, approach those developers and see if
there's a collaboration.
Yeah, exactly. See if we can plug in your ideas. See if it can be possible to do it in. And then you might get results far quicker than if you go the middleware route. Because the middleware route, they can experiment, see if they can get it to run and if it to sound. But then if you want to find out if it actually works in the game, then it has to be sold to somebody else.
It's another step.
Exactly. Yeah. And then the middleware company has to take the risk of buying into your technology, thinking that other people will buy into it.
Mm-hmm.
That's two more risks.
Yeah.
And that makes it even more complex. So I think he's wrong there. I think the middleware is not the area where you can take the most risks as far as
trying out these new technologies.
Yeah, exactly. Sure. You know, you don't see HDR coming out on WYs first. It happens in the fringes first, and it happens to be successful, other people want it, then it appears in the middleware.
Yeah, and that's true time and time again in a tool. Right. Or yeah. even a gameplay, right? You're seeing indies taking more and more risks with presenting gameplay that is outside of
exactly.
the norm.
Yeah.
And whereas you do get, you know, AAA games that come out of nowhere with a gameplay mechanic that blows everyone away, I feel like it happens so much more frequently on the indie level that...
Yeah, well, we were talking just recently with Sean McGrath.
Yeah, from Dyad.
From Dyad, who worked on the game on his own for 4 years.
Yeah.
Well, he can make his own choices. He there's nobody that's telling him what he should do, and he's very, very adamant about that. He's really made that clear. We'll get that to you soon. I'm sure, you know, if you had something that where he really believed in it, somebody like that, you know, he would take it, implement it himself.
Absolutely.
And you would get very honest feedback on whether or not it actually did anything for him.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, good call, Anton. That's a great insight, a great perspective on that. So these are the kind of ideas and inspirations that come out of having gone to a conference like this.
Hmm.
I mean, this isn't stuff we're just making up off the top of our head, right? These are ideas that have been inspired and fostered through 3 days of, I think, laser-focused, intensive game audio.
Hmm.
Man, that's like powerful stuff here, right? So, I guess, to sum that up, yeah. Cool stuff.
Cool stuff.
The last session of the day was MIDI versus the real thing. And that was from Laura Cartman, a composer. And essentially what she was doing was showing examples between compositions created with MIDI and compositions created using live instruments. And what she was trying to put across is, you know, are we there yet? Can we accurately bring across the compositional technique and emotion using MIDI versus MIDI and sampled instruments versus real recording, a recording in a real world situation? Again, a lot of great examples. I think everyone kind of walked away with a different idea about whether or not it actually worked.
Maybe there was a different idea, as in one said yes, the other said no, and before they already thought yes instead of no. Or do you think she changed a lot of people's minds?
Well, I think everyone hears something different. Hmm. So I think everyone comes away with their own idea.
As Stefan rightly pointed out.
Exactly.
Perception. Actually, one of his most important points about a sound was that it's not just that sound, but it comes with all your baggage. So he started his talk. I think we missed it when we talked about it the other day.
We did.
He started his talk with a sound of a prop plane passing by. Well, I call it a prop plane because that's what I heard. It's a pass by of an airplane.
It was a Spitfire.
It was a Spitfire, but that was not what I heard. I heard a prop plane going through the air, going past very fast. Somebody was putting their hands in front of their ears. It was nice and loud. And then he started to talk about perception and how sounds are different for everybody. And then he ended it, and that's where I felt like he was for sure clearly preaching to everybody.
Mm-hmm.
Saying that Spitfire sound for him made him cry because for him it's the sound of freedom, as the Spitfires were the only thing saving people in London from the German bombers in the Blitzkrieg.
Right.
Or no, that wasn't Blitzkrieg, but from the bombs falling over London. Mm-hmm. So, a very emotional sound for him, even though he wasn't there, but his grandfather was. And a very powerful example of how those perceptions are
changed the way you hear.
Yeah, exactly. So, and that's why I immediately thought of it when you say this music and the answer for that is different for everybody, because everybody, of course, has a very different emotional reaction to music in particular, but any kind of sound.
Absolutely, absolutely. Yeah. So, well, it was good that she brought the idea to the conference again, because I feel like part of the goal is just to get people talking about it, get them thinking about it, and... So glad that she brought that there. Excellent. So at the close of the conference, Michael Kelly took the stage and he, essentially laid down one of the key things that drove this year's conference was inspiration. And that ran through everything from the Robin Rimbaud keynote throughout several of the sessions, which, again, I think for me, definitely inspired more thought, and that is a huge takeaway from me for that. So Michael Kelly got up, he gave thanks to all the people who helped coordinate, committee members, as well as all of the gracious volunteers who helped out. There was a drawing for some special prizes, and that was kind of fun. One of the secret things happening underneath this conference, which was amazing, was the Audio for Games hashtag on Twitter.
Mm-hmm.
And anyone out here hearing this, go find that, search it on Twitter, and you will find an incredible depth of information, feedback, insight, opinion, and general conversation surrounding this event. And I feel like there were so many people enabled to give feedback and to express themselves during these sessions and during the conference. It was just a beautiful unification of what was like a very game audio summer camp-like environment. At the end of the night, everyone piled out of the conference. We went out and got some more drinks. We had some food. And really, it was like saying goodbye at the end of camp.
Hmm.
These were people that we'd been living with for 3 days. It was a small enough conglomeration of people. And by the end of it, you really felt like you had met almost everyone at the conference.
Yeah.
And had conversations. And it was parting a sweet sorrow, for yeah. sure. Because the intimacy of it for such a, again, focused conference like this really just inspired a sense of community. And so, brilliant. Thanks to everyone who contributed to that Audio for Games hashtag. Thanks for being part of the conversation. And thanks to all our listeners at Game Audio yeah, Podcast.
Thank you. And thanks for those who are listening that attended the conference. It was great to meet a lot of you.
Yep. We hope we can see you at the next one, whichever one that may be.
And expect a lot more material from the conference to end up on the podcast soon. We've got quite a few interviews, top of my head. We got Fabric on. We got Michael Kelly. So Tasman Audio from the Fabric for Unity. We got Michael Kelly and
Stefan Schutz.
Oh, so, and a few others. So
keep yeah. your ears open.
And we met plenty of new people that will someday make it on the podcast.
Anton,
can't wait to chat more with them.
It's been an amazing conference. I'm looking forward to the next couple of days to just chill here in the Netherlands with you.
Yeah.
It's going to be great.
Reminisce.
And I'm kind of spoiled this year. I get to see you at GDC again in a month.
Yeah.
And so I'm grateful for that and glad for that. In the meantime, Game Audio, get out there. Get talking. Keep the conversation going.
Yeah. And think of that we have really something special in this professional community.
True that.